So in this last 10 or so minutes of the Dharma talk time for this retreat, I'll do the kind of final little conclusion on the topic of equanimity. And since I'm supposed to have something to say about equanimity, and I should know something about it before coming over, I look to see how the dictionary defines it. And I was slightly surprised, just because I thought, oh, is that simple? equanimity in my dictionary is defined by calm and composed. And I kind of delighted in the word composed, because composed to me is a word of integration, of being integrated, being settled on oneself. All the different factors of who we are in balance, but not in a balance like in a teeter-totter, but a balance like, I don't know, like something that's been built and everything is put together in a balanced way and it's firm and stable. And and I love it that the word equanimity, equanimus, comes from this Latin root of even animus. And animus, animated, has a very rich connotations, and I associate very much with the idea of life, to be animated. And so to live a life that's has a certain kind of balance or evenness, but it's life, you know. So the wonderful life that we have, to have it live through us in a way that is not lopsided, is not, you know, partial or something. And you know, it's clear that in some areas of life, how important it is to be equanimous. And I was thinking about, you know, I'm involved with this chaplaincy training program for many years. And in the early years, there was a man who did it, who was an immigrant from another country. And he decided to, his volunteer work was going to be visiting people in a nursing home, retirement nursing home, I think it was a care home for people who kind of, and who came from his home country and who'd gone through a lot of challenges there, a place of war and different things. And he'd been through some of that himself. And he came and talked to me about what it was like to talk to his people he visited. And he said, I visited this person and at some point, the person stopped me and said, I feel like I'm taking care of you, but you're here to take care of me. The chaplain, right? Feel like you have to take care of the chaplain? But because of the similar background, the unresolved distress and suffering and fear and different things that he had were still being triggered. And so what he conveyed to the person he was trying to support and bring some solace to or peace to or somehow support the person was the opposite. He elicited from the person like that person had to support me. And that's not really how it should be for a chaplain. A chaplain is supposed to bring something. And one of the things I like to do in terms of, you know, our Buddhist chaplaincy training program is we have a requirement. You're supposed to have sat a number of silent 7-day retreats, because I believe that this kind of practice that we do here has people discover how to be equanimous, how to dip deep down inside and find a capacity for peace, for non-reactive presence, a capacity to be present. For chaplains, meet some of the greatest tragedies of people's lives, but to be able to meet that tragedy and be able to stay balanced, stay open, stay not caught in their fear, not caught in their dismay or despair or their anger, but rather to offer a kind of equanimous or peaceful presence that supports the person to somehow move through and work through what they're doing and find a way that's appropriate for them to find their resolution or their place of strength or their place of support for what they're going through. And that's hard for the chaplain to do if the chaplain is triggered by this and gets, the patient goes into the patient and asks the patient, how are you? Well, I just was told that I have to sign up, I have to start hospice. And the chaplain goes, starts screaming, and that's terrible, we can't have that happen, and that shouldn't happen, and this is terrible, and starts running around the patient's room, that person shouldn't be the chaplain. In certain settings of life, you want to be with people who've done their inner work and know themselves well, and not easy work, but to do that work so they can show up and have a certain kind of equanimity. And in some settings in life, what we convey through how we are with the challenge of life is what we pass on, what is contagious, how we are. And it's particularly true for children. And so teachers and parents, if they are anxious about the world, if they are scared or if they're angry, then they pass on the idea that it's appropriate, the world is a place that's appropriate to be scared in or appropriate to be angry towards, and that's an okay thing. And so, kids are so impressionable, and they learn how the world is, especially when they're really young, from how their parents are. And probably, I can imagine a room with so many people here. Some of you know this very well because you learned lessons from your parents at an early age that somehow it became ingrained as the way things are. And so if a parent is able to show a child that the parent feels at home in this world or feels like this world is a world which certainly has dangers in it, and the parent shows that they're relaxed and calm about that and equanimous about that, but also not dismissive of that, that they're also willing to take the care of things and look ahead and try to do what we can. And that balance of finding a place of peace and ease in a world that has dangers. If we try to insist on being safe in all possible ways, we actually make the world more dangerous. And we don't teach healthy things to our children that way. But if we can show them that, yes, there are challenges here in this world. You might get sick. You might die. There might be accidents. There might be, here in California, earthquakes. There might be fires. There might be all kinds of things. And so what do you want to convey to your children about how they're going to be for the rest of their life? And so I think that part of the hope I have for parents is that they have also done their work, so they can convey to the children that this world is manageable, that it's okay, that you don't have to be 100% safe to be at ease, to be equanimous, to find a kind of peace at the center of it all, a peace in the center of ourselves. And to expect that the world has to line up just right so we're safe is not really to be safe. The safety has to be inside, the feeling at home inside. So this task of discovering what equanimity is kind of a huge, life task. It's a wonderful, powerful, significant thing we do, not just for ourselves, but we do it for others as well. And what the Buddhist practice points to is that, if you allow me to say that if the lights go out outside, then you find the light inside. And we're trying to turn on the light, so it's always here, the inner light. And then we have all these lights. We have treasures and treasures, troves of treasures internally that can support us in very meaningful and significant ways as we go through all kinds of things, including facing our own death. And so these wonderful qualities that Nikki talked about, the paramis, the perfections, they don't exist, actually, except in your heart. That's where we find them. And so to cultivate that, and have those, that turn on a light of those things, the seven factors of awakening, the Brahmaviharas. There's all these wonderful things that reside in us, not in the Buddhist books. That's just kind of, you know, comparatively, that's dead stuff. But, you know, it's the living, the animus is here in us. And then as these things become stronger, then it becomes more and more makes sense to talk about equanimity. To have, not have those resources inside, it might be kind of challenging, not really appropriate to emphasize equanimity or finding a peace, you know, at home in the world. But to have these things be strong, and to repeat some of the things I said the first time, first talk, there are many factors that contribute to our capacity, inner strengths, inner lights that contribute to our capacity to be equanimous. Our ethical integrity, how we speak to people. You know, are we mean? Are we kind? These are hugely consequential in our capacity to develop some ability to trust ourselves, to have faith that's okay not to be reactive and find some equanimity. I think that if we live an unethical life, it's a lot more likely for people to have reasons to be non-equanimous. What we have faith in, to cultivate strong faith or trust or confidence in the practice, in ourselves, and three treasures, in a variety of things, but to find that confidence inside. In Buddhism, they talk about confirmed confidence. So discover how you can really confirm it for yourself, the truths of the practice. And then you carry those with you, and that gives you a lot of the confidence. You know, you have a path, you understand something. So no matter what happens, you can feel like you can be more balanced with it. You don't have to, you know, get overly anxious about it. And then there's the equanimity that comes from cultivating your mind, developing concentration, for example, developing calm. If you know you can have the capacity to be calm, then, you know, you've cultivated that, then you can go into situations, okay, well, I can rely on my calm. I can take some deep breaths. I can relax. I know how to meet this in a calm way. Then we don't have to be anxious about the worry about going into a difficult situation. We have a strength that we carry with us that balances us. There's the strength that comes from wisdom. Over time, we begin understanding things. We have the overview of upekkha. We start seeing what's going on. And one of the, I know lots of people who have developed equanimity about challenging social situations when it occurred to them that the challenging person they were with was actually suffering. And that and it was in their suffering that they were grumpy, in their suffering that they were short-tempered, and their kind of stress that they were living under, that they did something that was hurtful. And not to deny that it was hurtful, but that, to people say, oh, the person's suffering, I understand. So then there's a kind of a more equanimity, a more space. Okay, that's what's going on. So there's, it's all these different kind of categories of wisdom, of understanding the situation that we can develop and cultivate over a lifetime where we're not so reactive, so caught up. I remember that a very informative experience for me in equanimity was... I was 14, did not have a driver's license, and my friend and I saw the keys to my father's car, and no one was home except his car outside. And it just happened that his car was parked next to a bulldozer. And my friend, who thought he could drive, got in the car and turned the car on to have it going, and the car lurched right into the bulldozer. And the bulldozer was fine. So I said, oh, well, this is not good. So I went home and called my father. And I said, you know, your car. And, you know, we crushed it. And he was really calm. He said, does it still drive? And I said, yes. And, you know, what's happened to it? Well, we can't open the right-hand door. And he said, well, why don't you look at it and see what you can do, and I'll look at it when I come home. That was it. Last I heard of it. And maybe he heard in my voice that I, you know, how I felt about what was going on, and he felt no need to be angry or anything. But to be received that way and be heard that way without being shamed or receiving his anger, it was actually a deeper lesson for me about care, respect. It was a lesson about being honest. I was admitting it. I called him up and told him, right? And so if he'd been angry with me, I think that would have been, at that early age, it would have been a lifetime lesson about anger and about shame and about things that probably wouldn't have served me. But I got a very different lesson because of his equanimity, his calm about that. So I don't know what wisdom he had about that. And then there's the wisdom of insight. We're practicing insight meditation here. And to have the capacity to really see with clarity some of the really basic building blocks of what's going on in our experience, that can bring equanimity. And then the final form of equanimity, that so to just show that equanimity is a dynamic thing, many things contribute to it. The final thing that brings equanimity is our freedom, our inner freedom. If we've discovered how not to cling, how not resist, not to get attached to things, and have let go of things, you know, have some freedom around it, then we're equanimous about it. You know, like, you know, my 13, 14-year-old self was not equanimous about how long my hair was. I don't, you know, right now, that's not an issue. If I wake up and it's shaved, if I wake up and it's down to my belly button again, it's not, you know, whatever, you know. That's not an issue. Hear a fire alarm, fire truck, is that what it is? I can imagine that it's a little bit alarming given what we've talked about today and all the issues of today and what does it mean? And probably means something. Is there some kind of integrity, some kind of trust and faith that you have, some kind of developed mind, capacity for calm, some kind of wisdom, some kind of insight, some kind of freedom that allows us to kind of take a deep breath, breathe easily, and consider what's happening and consider what the wise thing is to do? But not to get alarmed or not to get, you know, run around and lose our calm. How is it for us? What kind of world do we want to live in? What kind of world do we want to leave behind us? And I think that we leave behind us how we are. The people we know and how the people we've touched in our lives, we leave that behind by how we are. And so I think one of the great tasks is to leave behind a capacity to be not spinning out, not getting caught in the grips of anger and anxiety, and to be equanimous. There's a task of compassion, tasks of all kinds of wonderful things. And for this week, you have all been involved in one of the great tasks of a lifetime. I put tremendous, tremendous value in the work each and every one of you have done here. I know it's not easy. I know that it stirs up all kinds of things. And it's almost like the more challenges you have, the more it's indication of, for me at least, how profound it is to meet yourself and to work on this. And the more difficult it is, it probably you're touching things which have even more deeper roots inside of you. And to really kind of go and touch those roots and find your way with them and find your resolve of them is one of the great things you do for the world. So thank you so much, very much for this. And now we can take 10 minutes or so if any of you have any. We haven't done any questions in the hall here, so now there's a chance if you have any leftover questions from the Dharma talks or instructions or... And we can ask someone to maybe carry the mic around. Yeah, we'll keep recording, doing the recording. And someone volunteer to Kurt? Even at the expense of losing a little bit of your equanimity, you can ask a question.
I'm wondering if you could speak a little bit about the significance of the bow as part of the practice.
It's a great question. Since I did all this talking just now, maybe we can have it be Nikki's turn. Is that okay, Nikki?
Yeah. Yes, I would love to talk about bowing. One of my favorite topics. The reason why I say it's one of my favorite topics, it's actually because I did not like bowing at all at the beginning when I started practicing and coming to retreats. And part of that was because of my upbringing. And as I mentioned, in a liberal Muslim family in Islam, you don't bow to anything and anyone except for God. And it's not so. So I had a very difficult reaction, actually, with bowing. So I had to find my own way of what it means. So, and that's how I relate to it, and I invite everyone to find a way that you relate to the bow for yourself, if it's meaningful. If it's meaningful, find a way. If not, please don't do it at all. You don't have to. There's no have-tos. But for me, when I'm actually bowing, I'm both connecting with my intention for being here, and it's an expression of gratitude for me, deep gratitude to everything, all the causes and conditions, seen and unseen, throughout life and universe that have brought me to this moment, to be able to be here and serve, and just it's an appreciation. So I'm not bowing to the Buddha, I'm bowing to everything, me, myself, well, I'm part of everything. So it's that. That's the way I find meaning in that. So I invite you to find meaning in the bow for yourself. And if it doesn't work for you, don't do it.
Just a follow-up. I find it a very convenient way to say thank you without speaking. Just, you know, if someone steps aside for you, or I found it pretty natural to, oh, here's a way to say thank you for letting me pass. That's
nice,
one way I use it.
Yeah, it's a wonderful act of communication. and it can communicate very different things at different times. It's like, I think you almost need a dictionary for all the different things that that bowing can communicate. And for me, I think one of the reasons I bow at the end of the sitting is I just have this upwelling of appreciation and gratitude, and I feel like it's good to give expression to it. And some things should be expressed so they can come alive in us. Without expressing it, they kind of don't really grow. And there's also a wonderful opportunity, occasion to bow, and that is when nothing else works. You have no idea what to do, nothing works, and then you're at complete loss. Try bowing.
Besides the meditation, I have found that in between the sits and the walks.
Can you say it a little louder, please? Again, say it again.
Besides the sitting and the walking, I have found it helpful to slow things down, to stay connected to equanimity. Tomorrow, when I get into onto 17 and go back to my power walking and all my computer work, do you have any suggestions how I can stay connected just a little longer?
I'll say something, and yes, so I think there can be a lot of calm and space and peace inside, even if the pace outside looks fast. You can, and at the same time, you can look very slow, but you're rushing inside, and there's no equanimity inside. But you can be running, power walking, and there is equanimity inside. And the way to stay connected to that, one way that I found helpful in my practice is mindfulness of the body, staying embodied, staying stable, just staying connected, feeling your body. That's one way. And especially as you brought up, sitting at the computer, that's often what I do when I have gazillion emails to answer. I go back to my body. Settling in. That helps support me.
And the other thing, one thing that I just learned is it helps is to just do one thing at a time. If you give yourself fully over to one thing, sometimes doing it fast is... it can actually help with the absorption and the stillness. And I've done things, I used to work as a fast food cook, kind of, and at a restaurant. And it was fast, and in some ways it was a lot of different things I was doing, because all these dishes had to be done simultaneously. But that's all I did. And it was like a dance. And at the end of the shift, I was really still.
I had a question about, I think it's called Vedana practice, when you notice like liking something or disliking something, or if it's neutral. Is that the right, I don't know if that's like how it's called, but with when things are neutral, like noticing a neutral reaction or response to something, whether that's at all related to equanimity or like could be helpful with cultivating it.
Awesome. I can start by saying, actually, yes, there is a relationship between Vedana and equanimity practice. So Vedana, feeling tone, often translated as, is just very simple tone that arises when the mind connects with an object, and the three tones are pleasant, unpleasant, and neither pleasant nor unpleasant, which is a mouthful, so we say neutral. So pleasant, unpleasant, neutral. And from that, often liking or disliking or checking out arises. Okay, so Vedana is one step earlier before any liking. It's just if a tone like, oh, blue, pleasant, this color, unpleasant. It's just very, very automatic, and it's not inherent in the object at all. It's the reaction of the mind, very subtle, happens all the time. So with the pleasant and unpleasant feeling tone, often there can be more, there can be equanimity with everything, but with the pleasant, the neutral tone, neither pleasant nor unpleasant, the Vedana of that, the feeling tone is the feeling tone that is experienced in a state of equanimity, because it's neither pleasant nor unpleasant, it just is. It just is. So that's one way it relates. Do you want to add anything?
So I didn't hear the full question at the beginning, but so it might not be related exactly, but the experience of neutrality, of neutral experience, is said in some of the ancient kind of tradition, or is that it's actually quite rare. And that when people have experienced a lot of neutral, it's probably a sign that they're holding themselves separate from their experience. And so if there's a lot of fence feeling of neutral, it might be interesting to see if you can step into your experience and be with it more fully. So I don't know if that's... So... The ship goes on. And so I think it's Kurt's turn to come and do the manager's announcements. Oh, yeah. Oh, I'm supposed to do it. Oh, yeah. We do. You can come up if you want. And, I'd like to use this time to do what's called IRC appreciation. The reason for that is that it can be easy to take what goes on here for granted, or not for granted, maybe just simply not know if you're new to hear what's going on here. And it's the way that IRC is set up is meant to be nourishing or nurturing and supportive for you, for your practice, for our community here. And there's a number of things we do that are supposed to be that nourishment. And so I just want to mention some of those things. And I think the idea that primarily I want to just say that the way that there's so many volunteers, everything that happens here happens from volunteers. And there are, I don't know how many, 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 many volunteers. We had a meeting here in May of the kind of the leaders of different teams, kind of, you know, that we have all these teams of volunteers. And there were 30 people, 28 people, I think, in that meeting. And that was just the people, you know, in charge of, you know, charge, not the right word, but kind of coordinators. And then there's been, you know, lots and lots of volunteers down through these years we've been here. We've helped with so many things, and because I was involved in this place since the very beginning and all the reconstruction we did, I know that just about everything you can see and touch here, not the wallpaper in the public bathroom downstairs. That's left over. But just about everything that you see and touch and look at, like the color of the white and the screws and the doorknobs and the, you know, just you can, you know, all this stuff. And I see acts of generosity. I see that there's people who've poured their heart and their love as volunteers to kind of think about this and research it and get the bells and clocks and, you know, everything has been, it's fun. It just blows me away how much generosity there's been, which represents a tremendous amount of goodwill. And in some ways, IRC is, the fuel of IRC is this goodwill that so many people have. The fact that we're able to offer the retreat freely in a building like this, I never would have guessed, you know, that the building like this would be available to us and that we could offer retreats freely. And we come and we offer food and yogi need closets and new, brand new lights. You know, it's a manifestation of many, many people's gratitude, goodwill, goodness, and generosity. This is kind of saturated with this here. And if there's some appreciation, some taking it in, maybe that inspires you and it feeds you. And maybe that supports your Dharma practice, inspires you to practice more. And let, you know, that's the fuel for your practice. And it was that way for me when I was in Asia. I would feel it was clear we were being supported to practice there by so many people in the community there. And I kind of felt, you know, I felt kind of, in a very good way, I think it was quite appropriate, and I have to practice harder for these people who are supporting me. And it actually was a wonderful kind of feeling of generosity, but just fuel for me to engage. So for this week, you have contributed to that. Some of you have contributed for a long time in different ways. But for this week, every one of you, through your practice, your being here, doing your work meditations, your kindness, there's so many different ways you've been part of this community and this field that's been created here, and I thank you. And I don't take it lightly. I'm nourished by it as well. I'm supported by it and inspired by what we have here. And if we can really appreciate this in a deeper way, then I'm hoping that it's contagious and that it can spread from here. And pretty soon we'll have IRCs popping up in every neighborhood.